We would like to acknowledge that the land which we are gathered on today is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. Ontario is covered by 46 treaties and other agreements and is home to many Indigenous nations from across Turtle Island, including the Inuit and the Métis. These treaties and other agreements, including the One Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, are agreements to peaceably share and care for the land and its resources. Other Indigenous nations, Europeans, and newcomers were invited into this covenant in the spirit of respect, peace, and friendship. Most of us have come here as settlers, immigrants, or newcomers in this generation or generations past. We are all treaty people. Every day, we are mindful of broken covenants and we strive to make this right. We commit to collaborating based on the foundational assumption that Indigenous peoples have their power, strength, and competency to develop culturally specific strategies for their communities. We are dedicated to honoring Indigenous self-determination, history, and culture, and are committed to moving forward in the spirit of reconciliation and respect with all First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people. Hello, everyone. My name is Linda Meeks, and I am your host today. I am one of the education facilitators at the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. Welcome to our podcast, Beyond the Stethoscope, a podcast focused on hospice palliative care. We have a very interesting episode for you today, and I would like to welcome Kathleen Bartlett, one of our nurse consultants, and Kara Spearin, who is actually a death doula supporting patients and their families at the end of their life journey in our local community. Today's episode, Kathleen will be having a conversation with Kara, and welcome Kathleen and Kara.
Thanks, Linda. Good afternoon all, and welcome to our discussion today around death doulas. Death doulas or end-of-life doulas are there to empower, educate, and encourage people and their families to be involved in decision-making, as noted by the End-of-Life Doulas Association. The word doula originated from Greek and has the meaning of servant or helper. Similar to that of a birthing doula, a death doula supports the patient in their end-of-life journey. They are able to support the patient over months or years, dependent on the diagnosis and prognosis. Their approach is holistic, individual, and patient-centered to ensure the patient's wishes, values, and beliefs are honored. In Canada, it is noted that there are over 100 practicing death doulas. So please help us in welcoming one of them, Kara Spearin. Welcome, Kara, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's really nice to talk to the professionals about my role here.
Awesome. So Kara, what exactly is a death doula and how did you get into this role?
I mean, it's a really broad title. Most folks have heard of a birth doula, like you've said. So it is just that, but for the end of life. So I like to describe myself and my role simply as a guide. So I am there to guide the individual and their family or their caregivers and their loved ones in whatever capacity they need. It's strictly holistic, you know, so I'm not doing any symptom relief. I'm not guiding them with any advice. I'm simply there to listen and ask them questions and kind of point them in the right direction based on their needs. It's very broad and it's very client dependent. Like I said, strictly holistic. What I can do is help assist in managing fears. I really like the idea of I'm giving the client control back in a time where they feel like they have no control over their body, no control over their symptoms, no control over their autonomy and decision-making. I can give them that and help them reduce physical symptoms by gaining control back. It's amazing how much, you know, our mind can control our bodies. I help them improve their sleep and allow them and their caregivers the proper space to process and grieve in a time that's really difficult. And I can kind of eliminate those logistics of hard choices and maneuvering resources. Yeah, and take the load off the family. There's a ton of great resources and services out there in Ontario. We're very lucky to have, you know, palliative care and hospice because that doesn't exist all over the world globally. So I'm able to kind of point them in the right direction, because it can be very overwhelming when you're facing end of life and when you're in crisis. So there's a lot of resources out there, but kind of pointing a client to the right one can be tricky. Navigating that is something I can help with. So my personal mission as a death doula, like you had mentioned, I'm going to guide the family or the individual through to their end of life. And my goal is to do it so that I'm giving them honor and I'm helping them to manifest meaning in both of their life and their death, not just death. This is about creating and understanding what means the most to them, what matters the most to them in their life.
Then what about your interest and movement into this field of work?
Yeah, so it's been kind of an interesting process. It's twofold, really. Number one, I've served the community locally as a paramedic for 18 years. So my background is in emergency medicine. Obviously, in the field, I've been witness to, you know, death and dying is pretty regular occurrence in every shift that I'm on. But I've also seen the need for filling that gap with end of life. I've seen, you know, folks die in their home in a way they probably didn't want to. And I feel that I can serve a need there for sure. And secondly, you know, I feel like it's a calling. I'm not sure, but what's drawn me to it, but I've served very well in this role, having, you know, more challenging conversations, just kind of being outright honest. And sometimes, you know, that's not always what people want to hear, but it's what they need in the time. I've always taken a lot from those calls where I'm dealing with death and dying. It's given me really great perspective, understanding, and it's made me feel gratitude. So I think that's all part of it.
Okay. And there's a quote saying that according to the UN, that growth is going to be significant in the first half of this century. The number of people over the age of 65 will increase by 60% from the years of 2015 to 2030. So 370 million people.
Yeah.
And because of this, we're seeing improvements in healthcare, the decrease in communicable diseases, advancement in medical technology, and a decline in fertility. So we also see the folks with terminal illnesses longer because of medical advancements.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, right now we're even seeing a rapid shift in the strain on the healthcare system, and that's only going to increase. So being able to kind of like take control back and bring care that is holistic back into the home to empower family and caregivers and individuals to, you know, take their matters into their own hands and make these decisions in an educated way, but not having to rely and fall on the healthcare system in those times, because rarely is death actually a medical event. This is a natural process of the human life cycle. And I think that we're so conditioned in our North American culture to, you know, add a doctor in, add some medications in. We don't like to watch suffering. We don't like to watch pain. We like to hide it away. And by bringing it back into the house, not only can we relieve the strain on the healthcare system, but we can relieve the burdens, the strain, and the pressure on the family. Now, I'm not saying that's applicable for all people. There are folks that, of course, need assistance with palliative care and hospice at the end of life, and a caregiver simply just can't care for that person alone in their home without the proper supports. I'm not naive to that, but there are alternative ways that this person can enjoy the end of their life at home comfortably.
Perfect. And where do the death doulas obtain their training from? Like, how long is the program? And through your program that you did take, were you able to gain a lot of in-person experience or mentorship?
Yeah. So programming, I mean, this is an unregulated field. It's pretty new. I had only heard about it 2 years ago. So I was reading this book, Jan Arden. She was pretty public about the loss of her mother when she had Alzheimer's and dementia. Previous to that, she had lost her father, and it was pretty tumultuous. They had gone through quite a time dealing with his death. And so when her mother died and she wrote a book about it, they hired a death doula. So that was the first time I had read it in paper. This was like 2 years ago. And I was like, what is that term? It kind of resonated. So I had to like put the book down, Google it. And kind of ever since then, it had just been spinning in a loop in my brain, and I had to kind of look it up. So locally, I found some colleges that had programs that fit my schedule and my need, you know, full-time shift workers. I found this program called End of Life Doula. It's a certificate program. It was 8 weeks at Douglas College. So I did 8 weekends and became certified. Now, it was interesting because a lot of the stuff I kind of had already known, because I've, you know, essentially been working in the field for the 18 years. But for some people going in, they wanted to learn how to care for their aging parents better. They had gone through loss and just wanted to know about it. Maybe they were going in to do hospice training. So everyone kind of came at it from a different place, not necessarily to, you know, start a business. That's not for everyone. For me, I have like an entrepreneurial spirit. So I knew this was something that I wanted to be able to offer to the public. But so the mentorship, that piece, it doesn't really fall in line because not everyone is going out to use it for the same applicable process. So what I did was, you know, I've been joining different, you know, Facebook groups and networks. And essentially what I would recommend to anyone who's looking into doing this, because there's tons of programs, especially it's becoming more popular, you know, it's quite popular in Western Canada. They live a more holistic lifestyle. And, it, you know, California, there's a lot of programs you can find online. What I suggest is finding a program within your own country, within your own province, because each country and province has their own legalities and their own systems dealing with death and dying. And really, that's our only parameters that we're working with, like within the Ministry of Health and within Ontario law. Other than that, it's kind of free range. You can, you know, do whatever you want with it, make it whatever you'd like. So through the End of Life Doula Association of Canada, they have about 4 edited programs that they view, so you can become a member. So I recommend becoming a member, just because when you're a member of the End of Life Doula Association of Canada, you can be listed on their website. You know that person has had a criminal record check done. You know they've done 40 hours of volunteer work in the field, so they have some experience. Basically, this is, you know, a serious person that's had a solid background check and is familiar with the work, has done a program that's been recognized. So that those are good steps for me. But typically, any program you're kind of looking at, you know, a couple of months. Some are even like weekend courses. So it really depends on like your budget, your time frame, and what you'd want to do. But there are quite a few courses available. Douglas College is one that I did online. The Institute for Traditional Medicine in Toronto is one. The Home Hospice Association has a program, and Durham College also has a program. So along with mentorship, when joining the membership, then you have a network. You're then insured. So that's a good process, I'd say, for starting, because I had done my program and then I'm kind of like, what now? I had, you know, sat on it for about a year after I had finished this program and decided what I wanted it to be and built my own website. And, you know, there's quite a bit of work that goes into it for sure. Yeah.
And what services do doulas typically offer? And do you offer any legacy work?
Yeah, definitely. So with each client, basically I start with them and I do an initial meeting and then kind of make a plan from there. So with everyone, it's going to be different. I'll typically start with going through my version of an advanced care plan with them. So it gives me a really good idea of what their quality of life looks like, what they want their quality of life to be and remain, because that's different for everyone. So it's always really kind of centered around that, how I can support that and create meaning for this person. So I usually give folks a better idea of how this works. This is not covered by OHIP. So what I would do right now, I'm working on getting my 40 hours of volunteer services in place. So I have offered services for free at this point in time, but then I'll start with bundled packages. So people will pay out of pocket anywhere from $50 to $1,200 to $2,500, depending on what the services are. So I start with advanced care planning for everyone. That gives me a really good picture, you know, of where they're at and where they would ideally, you know, what a good death would look like to them, and kind of creating a plan. I help them access resources I will do a life review with them. So that's kind of where we get into, you know, are there any loose ends you want tied up? Are there any regrets? Do you need to finalize anything? My role with that client is then to be an advocate for them. So there's going to be moments when family might not agree with their wishes, might not agree with their plans, and I'll be a strong advocate for that person and maybe help facilitate family meetings. Right now I'm doing some educating. So I'm creating a program for first responders because that's obviously an area of interest for me. So I've created basically a training program for first responders in death literacy. I have some talks lined up with some elderly folks on what a death doula is and what I could do for them. So educating will be a big piece of this. I'm also going to educate the families on, you know, what to expect at end of life, what it looks like physically, what are the symptoms, what's normal, what's not normal, so they can recognize that. And that also goes in with that control piece and kind of eliminating fear. Essentially, I would love to offer vigil work. It's difficult right now because I am a single person in this company that I've started. You know, that requires team building and working with perhaps a group of volunteers, because doing vigil work might mean, you know, it might take 2 weeks for a person to die at the end of life. And if that person wants someone there around the clock, then that's going to take more than one person, obviously. I would help with funeral planning. So, you know, where they would like to end up. Do they want cremation? Do they want burial? What are the differences? What are the costs? Really going through the logistics of that. What are the final documents they need to have in place? Are they eligible for organ donation? Would they like to donate their organs? How will they go about doing that? I've worked with clients doing that previously. Implementing rituals. So depending on their religious or spiritual beliefs, what kinds of things are important to them in the form of a ritual. I mean, we just saw with the Queen's death, the rituals that went on there. So everyone has their own specific rituals that are important to them to implement at the end of life. So being clear on what those are. Grief support. Now, I am not trained in grief and bereavement, and that's something that I'd like to add to my arsenal down the road, but I am able to offer grief support with the family and client up until the end of life. At the end of life, after moving forward, I can resource and direct the family to grief support and make sure that they're supported appropriately. But personally, I'm not trained in grief and bereavement, so I leave that to the experts. Legacy projects, we will definitely do that. That's something that's very specific to the client. So that's a part of what I will help with, just getting their affairs in order, like the legal documentations. Have they chatted with their lawyers? You know, giving them a checklist that's specific and appropriate just for them. I can do holistic pain management. There's some great meditations, guided imagery that can really help with sleep and calming and relieving fears. I'm also a level 2 Reiki, trained in Reiki therapy. So I would offer that as a holistic treatment if desired. And then after death, I would help with body care and preparation if desired by the family.
Okay. And do you find do you find that the families want to participate in after death care at all?
Thus far, my experience has been no.
Okay. And do you offer any specific services for children? Like you had mentioned legacy projects. Do you find you work with children a lot, or is that kind of your
Haven't got into that, but I have been asked if that's somewhere I would go. And most definitely, I mean, the work that I would do with an individual and then with a family, with a child, it is really not going to be any different. So yeah, for sure. I would definitely go there and help. I think I could serve. It's still a person, not a whole lot different. And there are some great resources I can kind of direct people to as well.
And where is a death doula able to offer their services, and who all do they support? Mm-hmm. Can they support us as healthcare workers?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we'll be part of the care team, and essentially we can go into long-term care. Mostly you'd find us in someone's house. We would be in a hospital, hospice. Basically, we can be virtual as well if someone isn't up for a meeting, we can have meetings virtual. So as long as, you know, pending access and visitor rights, I know things can be up in the air right now, still with the ongoing pandemic, we'll be able to access that person anywhere.
Perfect. And how do you build capacity with those in the community that you're serving?
Well, and that's to your point of assisting the healthcare workers. So being a part of the care team, you know, essentially I can be an advocate for that person. I can be an advocate for the family. So it'll really be a communication piece. I mean, I'm not assisting in any of the healthcare procedures, but I am able to communicate wishes very clearly. So even just, you know, when things are clear, that makes it easier for the healthcare team. When things are organized, that makes it easier for the healthcare team. So can definitely work with them. But as for building capacity, like this is very new for me. This is very new. I don't know anyone else in the community that is a doula. I'm sure there are some out there, but maybe just a bit more privately. So really it's just by having these conversations, by talking about it, by sharing. And I would love to be able to build a team. I know there's lots of people in my line of work or that have worked in the healthcare system that are interested in this. I mean, we can see from my perspective, and that's why I've gone the holistic route, the misalignment that I feel sometimes with the healthcare system. When I am doing CPR on a person that should have a DNR, you're just like, what are we doing here? And you want to be able to serve in a better way. And I feel greatly like that's what I'm doing here. So I know there are lots of folks that would be interested in joining forces and feeling like you can serve in a bigger capacity than sometimes just driving someone to the hospital in an ambulance. And I know that's, you know, not what my job just is, but sometimes you don't feel like you're serving people all that well. Yeah, building a team would be awesome. Supporting a client fully. So that's going to start building my capacity. It's really word of mouth. I mean, people have to kind of know me and trust me. I think my 18 years of experience in the field speaks to that, certainly. Making connections, speaking engagements like these, providing education seminars, social media, people can see what I do from my Facebook page, volunteer programs. I'd love to organize those. I think there's people in the community, like we have our hospice volunteers that would be interested in volunteering and coming into people's homes and sitting vigil for, you know, an 8-hour shift, a 4-hour shift, whatever that may look like, and just being able to hold space. I would build by referrals and partnerships, you know, with the local hospices, with the local palliative care teams, with the local physicians, long-term care. There's lots of places where I can help and where this can grow and where we can all kind of work alongside to help people have better deaths.
And it's much needed too, especially in our line of work. We've seen that need, especially during the pandemic. If there is a volunteer able to hold vigil with somebody, that would make a huge difference and even give the family like a respite and a break. Reduce the
completely.
Burnout.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not naive to think that families can just do this on their own, because they absolutely cannot. And that's why, you know, folks end up they call 911 and that person goes to hospital and they end up dying in hospital. But, you know, most people, if you ask them, 85% of Canadians say they want to die in their home, but actually only 15% of Canadians are receiving palliative care in the last month of their lives. So being able to recognize earlier that, okay, this person is not well, because we do go into their homes and we can meet with them, and starting palliative care earlier, actually, as you know, will improve their quality of life for longer. So being able to access folks and set them up with the proper care that they need before they get into a point of crisis. I mean, there's also, when you do have families in crisis, and their loved one has died, they're making decisions perhaps from a wrong place. They're making decisions under a ton of pressure, under a ton of stress, under no sleep. And typically when this happens, you know, they're going to go to the funeral home and they're going to spend more money. And so we can kind of eliminate a lot of that
angst and suffering from them as well.
Completely. Yeah.
And how do you feel you're able to help change the experiences for patients and their families?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even with my last client, when I worked with her after our second session, she was able to sleep the night after we had kind of like really hashed out a lot of details. And I asked her some challenging questions and talked about things she hadn't talked about, like, you know, what she did want with done with her body and organ donation and things like this and legacy projects. And she started sleeping the night. So I was like, well, that's good enough for me. If that's all I can do for you, you're sleeping the night. That's amazing.
Yeah, give her some.
Yeah. So she was really appreciative, and she had an amazing care team. She had family support, a ton of friends. She had a palliative nurse in every day. She had her palliative doctor. She had PSWs. And even still, she was very grateful for my help and support, because I did ask her a line of questioning that her other care teams hadn't, just coming from a holistic perspective. Like, we take the medical diagnosis out of this, and that person just becomes a person. And, you know, what do you want your life to mean? Who is it that you are? What's important? So it becomes very personal. We really look at who that person is, and we figure out what's important to them so they can live their last days, you know, knowing what matters and spending the time where they want to spend it, who they want to spend it with. I think I'm able to bring a sense of ease and clarity, and I can help turn, you know, what can be an overwhelming crisis into something really meaningful. I think there can be, you know, death is powerful and it can be beautiful, and there's lots, it can reconnect people, it can heal people, and it doesn't have to be painful and scary and frightening. And I want people to experience that.
Opening up those lines of communication for sure. And are there any other experiences you've been present for that have helped to shape your practice today?
Oh yeah, definitely. It's really interesting because, you know, even before this end of life care had been a thought in my mind, I had started writing a little book on my computer about my experiences with death. I'm a songwriter and a musician, and I've written songs about death and interactions with clients. And so it's kind of always been in the workings there, but definitely each death is significant and touches you in a way, because it's, you know, not, most people don't experience that. Most people don't witness that. So the ones that have shaped my practice are definitely the ones where I've been able to sit with an individual, you know, touch their face, hold their hand, whisper in their ear some assurance. And that's always, for me, I know that's left a notable and a profound impact on them, especially in times of emergency medicine where you feel really helpless to a patient's suffering. You know, there's not a whole lot you can do. Like I mentioned before, you know, simply just driving that person to the hospital. I've learned that by staying grounded and holding the space and addressing the person's fears can simply be the most helpful and valuable care that you can give. Yeah, I began writing about some of these experiences that have kind of impacted me, and they've shaped my life, not only like, you know, how I operate as a paramedic, but how I operate in the world as a human and a mother. So you just kind of get a sense of how precious human life is. So I've got a couple of stories from those writings that I'll share with you. The first time I saw a dead body was when I was 17. The body was in an ER waiting to be taken to the morgue. My mentor gently walked me through the viewing and understanding. The rigor mortis, the lividity, the absence of breath. The entire experience was calm and respectful. My trainer showed me that this was now just an empty vessel, and I could feel that the soul had left this man's body. It was now an empty and used up container. You could sense the lack of connecting energy between the former being, and I'm eternally grateful for the guidance and have used the same teaching when guiding students or even my own children when talking about death and dying. So that was kind of one example of my first experience death and how that really shaped me and, you know, made it not a scary thing for me moving forward. I have a second story that I'll share if I could.
Absolutely.
And this one's about suicide notes. Throughout my career, I've come across suicide notes. Some you read and some you leave sealed for various reasons. The most beautiful suicide note I've read was written by a man who was still alive when we found him. He was in his 90s. He suddenly couldn't eat and had chronic pain throughout his body. He was wise enough to recognize that this was the end for him. He knew he was done for, and he didn't want to put everyone else through decisions, caretaking, suffering, and the cleaning. He ended his way and on his own terms, and I have much respect for this man I got to spend his final hours with. He wasn't sad. He wasn't upset. He went quietly by taking a bunch of pills. He wrote a single note and called on the nurse in the nursing home. It read, "I had lived a full life, and now it's time for me to go." If every person could know this honor, what a gift it would be. The nurse was obligated to call the family and then 911. When we laid him on our stretcher, there was no emergency. The only goal was peace and comfort. I held his hand and he smiled at me and he called me an angel. Perhaps the only time I've been called this in my career. We tucked him in with warm blankets into the hospital bed and I stroked his head and whispered comforts of safety and love. And he died that night. I felt honored that we could walk him to the end.
That's such a touching story. Thanks, Kara, for sharing that. And I love your line too, that you said, "I've learned that by staying grounded, holding the space and addressing fears, that can often be the most valuable and helpful thing anybody in care can do," which is absolutely true. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And that's what I want to share with the first responders and the care teams as well, that, you know, it's not always about reaching for the symptom relief kit and about calling the doctor or getting them to the hospital. There are other ways. And, you know, by addressing total pain, because it does exist, we can really help someone. And, you know, that's not something we're taught in school. That's something that we learn as we go through these experiences.
And how do you feel like that we as individuals, not necessarily as healthcare providers, but anybody listening to the podcast, can help to normalize death and dying for those in our lives?
Yeah. And I mean, it just starts by talking about it. You talk about it. Like, I mean, look at how we've been able to work on reducing the stigma of mental health over the years. And it's by talking about it. The same is for dying, which is interesting because we all know it's coming. We all know it's going to happen to us. But we think if we don't talk about it, we think if we don't plan for it or address it or even think about it, then maybe we'll be lucky enough to miss it. But that's not the case. So we must start by talking. And only 40% of the Canadian population had a healthcare professional engage them in conversations about managing chronic illness and giving them guidance. So even it starts with our physicians, our primary physicians, our paramedics who, you know, maybe that person's had a fall and they go in and lift them up and, you know, we ask a few more questions and we're moving towards that. Their nurses, their family members. And we can start by training the care providers to talk openly with their clients. So that's, you know, not only are we training in them, like how to recognize if this person needs palliative care, but we're giving them the language and the tools. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, recognize, you know, let's have conversations, but like, we can't have the conversations if we don't have the languaging. People are afraid to talk about death. They're afraid they're going to say the wrong thing. They don't want to upset someone. It can be, you know, it's a very emotional time. It's emotionally charged. And then for those people that are maybe providing care, it can activate some of their trauma as well. But if you really love someone, you're going to talk about death with them, I think.
Perfect. And for so many, death is feared. So getting out there, like you said, and talking to them makes a huge impact. So thank you for giving this information to our listeners today, Kara. We really appreciate your time.
So in your experience, now the paramedic system has come in Ontario with community paramedics. Can you maybe explain how your experience could see how speaking about death and having those tools for, say, community paramedics might be very beneficial?
Yeah. I mean, I think, and essentially this is happening where we, even if you're not a community paramedic, we're able to perform a checklist. If you're over the age of 65, you know, is this person having numerous falls? Are they living in a place that's up to par for living standards? are they able to care for themselves? So there is a checklist we do, and we can send off referrals. So then they'll meet with the, you know, what was the LIN, and they'll be assessed by CCAC to see if they need extra care. So that is happening. We are already doing that. And then beyond that, there are community paramedics that will come into your home. And basically this is avoiding a trip to the hospital, and they can come in and do blood work. Specifically, they're dealing with chronic illness such as diabetes, COPD, and CHF. And that is extending into palliative care. So that is in the works. Another thing that we're able to do now is do direct transfers from home to hospice. We can kind of bypass the hospital and say, yeah, I think this person needs a hospice center, and that would be the best place for them. So for paramedics to be able to call over to hospice and say, hey, do you have a bed? And we'll take the person direct. So it is happening. It is starting. Obviously it's a slow process, and it's training, but you're going to see, I think, palliative care paramedics in the field, which will be amazing.
Right. Basically, I was just sort of trying to see how beneficial the practices of a death doula, you know, maybe combined with community paramedics, how beneficial that would be for and their families.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be part of the overall care team. And I think the piece that the death doula serves outside of the care team is the holistic piece, you know, asking questions about what they actually want a good death to look like, because the palliative paramedics, they would strictly kind of be symptom relief and managing symptoms and maybe giving some education to the family and things like that. Whereas with the doula, it kind of comes in a step further and is just a little bit more personalized to that person's needs and wishes.
Thank you.
And Kara, again, just remind us the name of your business.
Yeah, I'm called The After Project. So you can find me online at theafterproject.ca and on Facebook as such as well.
All right. And do you serve all of North Simcoe Muskoka, or is there only a specific region that you'll service?
Yeah, I mean, I'm located primarily in Barrie. So I say the Barrie area, but I'm definitely available for Simcoe County. Simcoe Muskoka, depending on the location in Muskoka, sure. I mean, and then virtually. So it doesn't take a ton of work and meetings and setups. You know, each client's going to be different, but I can get a good grasp on what a person needs and what they're looking for in a couple of sessions, and then email and send resources from there. And even just a phone conversation is great too. Once I've met with that person, get a good idea of like what physical state they're in, what their relationships and caregiver setup is.
Okay, perfect. Thanks, Kara, so much. And again, thank you for your time and helping us to explore the role of the death doula today and how it can be utilized in the end of life transition. So thank you.
Oh, amazing. Thank you for having me and listening.
Thank you so much, Kathleen and Kara.